Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with architect Lee Ledbetter, whose new book is The Art of Place, Lee Ledbetter, Architecture and Interiors. And I'll share some memories of Baird Amos. Ledbetter is a Louisiana native, a well-known and much-beloved New Orleans architect. His practice, established in 1996, has won many awards for architecture and interior design. In addition to private residences, Lee has designed such familiar public spaces as the Bestoff Sculpture Garden at the New Orleans Museum of Art and the Joan Mitchell Foundation. Today, we're talking about his gorgeous new book, The Art of Place, Lee Ledbetter, Architecture and Interiors. Lee Ledbetter, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, it's a privilege to be here. Thank you, Susan.
Well, it's a beautiful book.
Thanks.
So tell us when you wanted to be an architect. That's a big dream.
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. When I was a child, my maternal grandmother told my mom that I would be an architect.
Wow.
And I drew as a kid. I even in the 6th and 7th, 8th grade, I would actually trace the plans of cities out of Rand McNally atlases, the blow-up plans of the cities.
Yeah.
Like if you saw California, there'd be a blow-up of L.A. and San Francisco at least, possibly even more. But the largest cities were blown up. I would trace the plans, and then I would go to town. I would just make them whatever I wanted them to be. Lots of interstate highway interchanges, you know, multi-level, sculptural, crazy concrete things, and always lots of palm trees, high-rises with Jetsons-type circulating restaurants on top.
Oh,
I drew
nice.
Cities in the Rockies completely underneath domes. So I loved the Jetsons. I loved anything space age. And I loved cities. I also drew floor plans of these massive houses that had almost no rooms with views. So the plans were so multi-layered in the horizontal dimension that only the perimeter rooms would have windows. Of course, I didn't realize for years that you couldn't inhabit these homes.
Of course not.
But no, I just always loved to draw. I started in pre-med, and after 1 year, I realized that I had to be an architect.
Wow. Now, you think of architecture, as I do, as a fine art. And so one of the things an artist does, at least I'm trying to find the right word for it, but like a writer, you have to find your voice. You have to find the language you speak as an architect. So what was that process like for you? You went to school, you studied various places. Tell us about some of the major influences.
Well, I appreciate that you also think of it as a fine art. I think I do because the earliest art history classes I took were always painting, sculpture, and architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I actually read art history books as a kid out of my parents' library. My parents had art history books because my mother had taken art history. I always took freehand drawing and painting classes even before I studied architecture. And I think it was a great foundation for architecture. A lot of people think architects need to be great at physics or math, and it scares a lot of people off who might have a proclivity to be an architect. And I think that's too bad because I think an art and art history foundation is just as important.
Right.
So I did take painting and drawing, and I took a lot of art history. And then when I transferred into architecture after those pre-med years, I was really attracted to architecture, or it became alive for me when a professor of mine at the University of Virginia who had studied at Cooper Union in Princeton, and he had studied under some of the neo-Corbusiists, I like to call them, the so-called white architects, the New York Five,
right.
Michael Graves, Richard Meyer. And these were architects in the 60s and 70s who were basically thinking of Cubist paintings when they made architecture. And so the particularly something called synthetic cubism, their architecture and their site plans had a, if you will, to use an art term, figure-ground relationship so that the architecture and the landscape had a kind of yin-yang interlocking. Mm-hmm. And this just spoke to me. After painting for years, to see architecture so directly related to painting, and particularly modern painting, was very exciting.
In the foreword to this book, the writer talks about your love of classicism and contemporary and blending the two.
That's exactly right. I grew up in Monroe in North Louisiana, which is a city that I would say boomed in the 40s and 50s. And there was a great architect there named King Stubbs. His son, John Stubbs, wrote the foreword to my book and is the professor of preservation at Tulane and had taught at Columbia and had an antiquarian bookstore, an amazing bookstore in New York for years, which you probably know about. But anyway, John's dad, King Stubbs, did these beautiful Neo-Palladian houses in Monroe in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And they were beautifully proportioned. Some of these houses were large vertical houses in the proportion of Palladio, but others were essentially ranch proportion boxes that he elevated just so much off the ground to give him a few steps. And then he would put a central portico on him with maybe four columns and a perfectly proportioned pediment. And he basically dressed these modern ranch type houses in classical drag, I would say. And I don't mean that pejoratively at all.
I know.
He did it beautifully. Likewise, there were some great architects in Monroe, Saul Mintz among them, who's a New Orleanian from the mm-hmm. Hurwitz Mintz family, who married a Monroean. And Saul designed some beautiful mid-century modern homes in the city. So as a child, I found myself forever, it seemed, until I had my driver's license, a passenger in my mom's station wagon with my head pressed against the window, just watching these houses go by in fast succession, one after another, almost like film stills in a reel.
Wow.
And some were modern, some were neoclassical, but they were all beautiful, largely because even if the architecture wasn't good, the landscape was so prominent. Mm-hmm. Monroe also has beautiful live oaks and azaleas. And these houses and these errands would happen daily, sometimes several times a day for up until I was 15. And I was even aware at the time that I was cataloging them. It's odd because I didn't, again, know I was going to be an architect at that point. But I knew that looking at these things again and again and again so quickly that they were being imprinted on my brain like a card catalog file.
Of course.
And so I think because of that, I've always appreciated both classicism and historicism and modernism. And also, classicism can't exist in modernism. So really, it's a better description to say historicism and modernism, because
right.
I think some of Mies van der Rohe's work is very neoclassical.
Mm-hmm. And how interesting that you were just imprinted with this. There's something so special about growing up in a place where you're constantly assaulted by the visual. You know what I mean? I think of New Orleans in that way.
Absolutely.
I see something new and different every day.
Absolutely. And New Orleans was the first city I visited, the first real city I visited as a child, because my mother's parents were here, as was her sister and her family, her sister's family. And there's a photograph of me uptown in a stroller with a close family friend's house behind me. And I remember, I don't know that I remember the two-year-old visit, but I do remember subsequent visits and how New Orleans was this just profusion of density, mm-hmm. green, canopy. It's a city that, unlike Monroe, which is, the buildings are largely horizontal in Monroe and spaced out, as are most sort of post-mid-40s American suburbs. New Orleans, of course, because of how little land there is, because we're surrounded by water, is a city that's, even where the buildings aren't tall, the buildings are incredibly dense. And there's a real beauty to that. The streets become better defined. It's also a city where you don't have a relationship to the sky like you do in so many cities. And I moved here from New York. I lived in New York between undergrad and grad school and again after grad school. And Manhattan has that same feeling because of the, quote, canyons of buildings.
Oh, yeah.
And when I moved to New Orleans, there was something very – I'd never lived in New Orleans. And so when I moved here in 93, there was something very similar in the kind of gestalt of the city that reminded me of New York. And I realized after about a month that it was because the sky is so limited here because of the live oaks.
So true. So true. You know, I think of the, you know, you escape to New Mexico and people go crazy when
yes.
they see so much sky because
yes,
they've
yes,
never
absolutely.
Seen it before.
Absolutely.
It's so interesting.
And I don't think I would know what to do with so much sky. I sort of like the the wound quality,
the protective
of
feeling.
The protected ceiling here and in New York.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Lee Ledbetter, author of The Art of Place, Lee Ledbetter, Architecture and Interiors. We'll be right back. What kinds of things do you take into account when you're doing public spaces, when you're working on those kinds of things, like the Bestoff Sculpture Garden, which is so extraordinary, and the Joan Mitchell Center? Talk about the difference in taking on public spaces rather than private homes.
Public spaces are, they're more users, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
So architecture, as much as any architect, loves to think of him or herself as an artist. And as we spoke about earlier, but it is a service industry. And our job is to make people feel secure and safe and to make people secure and safe.
Yeah.
But our job is also to, just like with a house, public buildings and houses, our job is to fulfill people's wants and desires. We call that the program of the building.
Mm-hmm.
So with any project, whether it's a house or an artist studio building at Joan Mitchell, or the Sculpture Garden, particularly in the Sculpture Garden, we designed most recently the indoor gallery pavilion. We interview the client, and this is not just one meeting. This is an evolving process.
I mean, sure.
We hone in on really what the needs are, what the budget supports. And often clients come to us, in fact, usually clients come to us. It used to be torn out images from magazines, but it's now mostly Pinterest boards, and clients come to us with lots of images, and I find this extremely helpful. It's really great to be able to wade through and get a sense of what they respond to, what their preconceptions are, because we want to fulfill their dreams with these buildings. And then, of course, we respond tremendously to the context. I don't think architecture at its best sits alone. I don't think buildings at best sit alone by themselves.
Right.
They respond to their context, are informed by their context. And for me, that's a great thing. There's nothing scarier than thinking about an artist facing a blank canvas with nothing to start with other than what's his or her head. And that can be a bad thing, right?
It can get pretty crowded
right.
in there.
Yeah, right. And, I often hear artists say some of the best paintings they've done is when they were just sort of free associating and completely uh-huh. relaxed and in their mode, so to speak. And I don't think architecture can be really quite like that. And I'm grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Early on, one of your early projects was Bayou Bonfuca for George Dunbar, which is one of the most beautiful houses in this book. So what is it like to design a house for an artist and with an artist?
That was the experience of a lifetime, and it was my first house from the ground up. I learned as much from George Dunbar, I think, as I did from any professor in architecture school. George had a very clear idea of what he wanted, not so much what the building itself was going to look like, but rather what the scale of the building should be and how it should sit on that site. That site can be seen from a full mile and a half up the bayou.
Wow.
And then across the bayou from the site, there is a marsh, a federally protected wetland, because there are bald eagles that nest in large pines there. And George understood much more than I did that the house had to, quote, hold that site. The site's a promontory where the major bayou feeds into a canal system, and it's slightly elevated. I would say a little bit more than slightly elevated. So it's really a hilltop. But he understood, and he taught me to think about architecture not just the way we're trained to do so, which is on a drawing. But George understood, for instance, here's a good example. He understood that the roof pitch on that house had to be oddly pitched, like dramatically pitched, mm-hmm. in order to not disappear in perspective when you were down on the bayou. Because
wow.
you're so much lower than the house, it would just recede perspectivally, I would say.
Uh-huh.
So he fully understood that. So we did this exaggerated roof pitch, and it was a great lesson. He was great to work with.
But the light in that house is just glorious when you look at these pictures.
It remains one of most people's favorite house that I've designed, and sadly, it was my first.
Hard to top the great thing, you know. Now, you have two of your houses in this book as well, and you live in a very interesting house that's on the National Register. So talk a little bit about having free reign in your own space.
I don't know if I'd call it free reign because the house that we live in comes with such pedigree, I guess I would say.
It does. It really does.
And so I feel the responsibility of that every day, but mm-hmm. I also welcome it. The house was designed by Nathaniel Buster Curtis of the really important American architecture firm Curtis and Davis, who, of course, was located in New Orleans in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And they had offices all over the world. In New Orleans, at one point, they had over 300 people in their office, and they did projects all over the world. Their most famous building, of course, is the Louisiana Superdome, which I think is still a timeless building.
It's
still just a really beautiful form. And actually, it's a tribute to that building that it's, after all, since I think it was finished in 75, that it's 74, 75, that it's still a functioning stadium.
Yeah.
It's been renovated, but it just shows how adaptable the structure was. But the house was the project that Buster Curtis is on for his wife, Frances, and their seven children. And it's really this masterpiece of, I think, an interplay of built spaces and unbuilt spaces. In other words, of pavilions and courtyards. And
it's amazing, so many spaces like that.
Yeah.
And I love it that Frances didn't want stairs, but she got them anyway.
Yeah.
And one of the sons said, I loved climbing on that house.
Yeah.
That he would literally climb up on the house and get on the roof and look around.
And on the walls.
Yes.
So the house is surrounded by walls. The house is set back behind a large 8.5-foot wall that is built at the setback line of where the building could have been, but they actually built this, what's essentially a garden wall, but it looks like a garden wall, but it has a wrought iron gate in it, pulled the house back about 15 feet so that there were these courtyards that could be seen from within the house, did another layer of courtyards, two rooms back. So it's like, I colored this tartan plaid between built and unbuilt, but it was really genius what Mr. Curtis did, not only because of how it made the house function, but also because it really paid respect to the neighboring Victorian houses by appearing not to even be there. I mean, how do you build
that's pretty amazing.
How do you build an avant-garde house, which is what it is, in 1963, in the middle of really some of the most beautiful Victorian houses in the city, and have it not contrast too much? Or
not to put too fine a point on it, to anger your neighbors.
Yes.
I mean,
no,
you know?
That's exactly right. And so it just looks like a garden wall for one of the other houses.
Mm. So books like this serve a number of purposes. They are art books. They're inspirational books. For you, this is a book that you can have in your office and have every client come in and go, whoa, I'd like that. But for you, it's personal. It's something very different. As you've described, you've been very hands-on in the creation of this book, the design of it, everything. So why a book? Why now? You were certainly with the best publisher for a beautiful volume. So talk about why this was the right time for you to do this and what it taught you about your own work.
I never thought I would have a book. I mean, honestly, I think we do great work, but we are in New Orleans. We're not in, you know, New York or LA or Paris. And really, it never occurred to me that I would have a book. A woman named Linda O'Keefe, who was the design editor for Metropolitan Home for years, had included me in not only Met Home when she was there, but in some subsequent books that she's written. She's a writer, and she's a really good writer. Linda approached me and suggested that the publisher who had published her previous book that had our house in it was interested to know if I had enough work, if my office had enough work to make a book. So we just scrambled and pulled together images, and I think the publisher was interested in doing a book on us. And I say us because this is I'm not Lee Ledbetter. I'm Lee Ledbetter and Associates. I'm a
right.
group.
And yes.
This book belongs to everybody that's worked for me for 20 years. I feel strongly about that. I've been very, very fortunate to have amazing people with fairly little turnover. But anyway, back to this. I think the publisher was interested in us because there are a lot of books from designers in New York and LA. And I think the fact that I was in the South, and particularly the fact that it's New Orleans is, as you know, not only in literature, but in design, it's so seductive. And mm-hmm. people love reading about New Orleans. People love the history, the culture of New Orleans. People love looking at pictures of New Orleans. So I think that was a big part of it. And the other thing is they were very interested in the fact that we are equally serious about architecture and interior design. And there aren't many architects that do both. And there are few, if any, interior designers who do architecture. So
right.
that, I think, was part of what prompted them to reach out through Linda.
Now, I have a question. You're an architect. You're always doing the next thing. And so here's your house, which is so beautiful. Are you at home there? Do you ever get restless? Do you think, I've done my house. Maybe I need another house.
I'm a serial homeowner.
Are you? Ah, okay.
There were actually two other houses that we thought were going to be in the book. And when we were editing the book and making the tough choices about what stays in and what needs to come out to keep the book within the page count, it was more important to me to lose projects, but to have the projects that are in there fully described. We have moved a good bit. I guess my fantasy would be to someday, it's actually my fantasy and it's also very scary, but to someday live in a house that I designed.
Oh, that would be exciting. Yes.
Yeah. The problem is that when you live in a house that you design, I think when an architect lives in a house that he or she designed, I think we're probably much harder on ourselves for our mistakes than we are in a house that we inherited.
Of course. People talk about New Orleans in terms of elegance and decadence. I think you put the elegance in every place
you work on.
It's gorgeous. We've been talking with architect Lee Ledbetter, whose gorgeous new book is The Art of Place, Lee Ledbetter, Architecture and Interiors. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
An appreciation. New Orleans lost one of its great literary ladies Sunday, October 6, when Berthe Amos died at her home in Past Christian. She was 94. Berthe was so much more than an author-illustrator. She was a children's book columnist for the Times-Picayune from 1982 to 1993, the publisher of Cocodrie Press, a consummate networker, as well as a longtime teacher of children's literature at Tulane University. She brought her long experience in reading to her newspaper reviews, and she knew the best when she saw it. As her editor at the paper for several years, I benefited from her knowledge. Many of her Tulane students went on to publish their own books, and Berthe's Writing and Illustrating Children's Books for Publication, Two Perspectives, co-authored with Eric Subin, remains a useful guide for authors starting out. It was always exciting to visit her class at the end of the semester and see the mock-ups the students had made of their own books, books that she had cheered and inspired. Most of all, Berthe's work was rooted in home. The Marvelous Catch of Old Hannibal and Old Hannibal and the Hurricane are picture books set on her beloved Gulf Coast. Her line drawings were particularly charming, and those of us who knew her books would recognize that distinctive style anywhere. And Berthe's artistic style was matched by her skill in prose. Chalk Cross and Secret Lives are evocative depictions of life in New Orleans for young adult readers, still classics. I first met Berthe in 1986 at the Louisiana Women Writers Conference held at Loyola University. After I finished an introduction with her impressive professional credentials, she poked me with her elbow and said, "You left out the most important thing. I'm raising six sons." Her priorities were always clear, and she managed to do it all, raise her family, write and illustrate her books, entertain her multitude of friends, and run a publishing business, all while remaining true to her art and her vision. She will be missed by all who knew her and by all the readers, young and older now, who knew her through her books. Berthe Amos published her last book, Mischief and Malice, in 2015. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Octavia Books presents New York Times bestselling novelist Renee Adier discussing her novel The Beautiful with her editor, Stacey Barney, Tuesday, October 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. This is a ticketed event, tickets available at Octavia Books. Historian Carolyn Cobb concludes the series The History of Jefferson Parish with Part 6, Jefferson Parish in the Recent Past and Today, Parks, Artists, Writers, and Government, Wednesday, October 16th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. Latin American Writer Series presents Peruvian writer Gabriela Wiener, interviewed by Gabriela Alemán, Thursday, October 17th at 5:30 at the Stone Center, 6801 Ferret at Tulane University. This interview will be conducted in Spanish. Robert Brantley discusses and signs Sacred Ground, Cemeteries of New Orleans, Thursday, October 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Garden District Bookshop presents an evening with Chef Sean Brock, in conversation with Chef Kelly Fields, discussing his book, South, Essential Recipes and New Explorations, at the New Orleans Culinary and Hospitality Institute, 725 Howard Avenue. That's Thursday, October 17th at 7. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Five local poets, Whitney Mackman, Karen Massera, Deb Janerson, Kathleen Balma, and Gina Ferrara, read and discuss their work Thursday, October 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Dogfish presents Lisa Passold and Rodrigo Toscano reading from their work Thursday, October 17th at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Today's guest, Lee Ledbetter, discusses and signs The Art of Place, Lee Ledbetter Architecture and Interiors, Friday, October 18th from 6 to 8 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. That's part of Friday Nights at NOMA. There will be a writer's clinic Saturday, October 19th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Gene Redmond discusses structure at 9:30 a.m., followed at 11 a.m. by Book Project Templates with Tracy Ann Grigetti, author and translator. Jax Fry discusses and signs her book, The Gumbo Sisters, Saturday, October 19th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Paula Arai discusses and signs her book, Painting Enlightenment, Healing Visions of the Heart Sutra, Sunday, October 20th at 1 at Octavia Books. And coming up, Octavia Books presents Ta-Nehisi Coates, reading and discussing his first novel, Water Dancer, in conversation with novelist Jesmond Ward, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at Octavia Books. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.